comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on earth. It's the show where you matter. Now, for those of you who have joined our members area, you received an email from me today that has a link in it where you can download the ebook that I promised you. So you want to be sure and check your email, your actual email, not the not the private messages in the members area, but your email. If you did not receive that, it is because you do not have your current real email address listed in your profile. Remember, nobody but you and me can see your email address in your profile. If you're not a member, at least, if you're not going to join, at least let us give you the free weekly newsletter. You know, I got an email from someone today that said, you know, it named a certain guest and said, you know, it's his policy that all of his interviews have to be free and open to the public, so you have to post that interview that you did with him and make it free for everybody. Oh, well, all our shows are free and public and open to everyone, live, and that one was as well. But, you know, hey, Ahmadinejad has a policy probably that says I can't broadcast. There's probably some policy in the U.S. government somewhere where somebody's passed a policy that says Kevin Smith should only be able to talk about making biscuits. Yeah, well, you know, I set the policies for the show. They are all free, they are all open, they are all public. But if you want the convenience of listening to a particular show at your convenience, on your time, that costs me money, and you get to help with that. It's 23 cents a day. And we hope you'll join. That's one of the features in the members area. But like I said, those of you who are members, check your email, because the link to that free ebook was sent to you today. In the world of ufology, I bet there's not a single person that doesn't know the name of Stanton Friedman. He's a nuclear physicist, UFO investigator, researcher, pardon me, and someone very responsible for breaking open the case of the Roswell UFO crash back in 1947. He is an author, a lecturer, and someone who has taken on the debunkers and the media with facts and evidence. Stanton Friedman will be my guest this evening on the other side of the break that's coming up, and we're going to be talking about the possibility that there are changing attitudes among global leaders in regard to the subject of UFOs and extraterrestrials. Wonder what those changes might be. He has just returned from a conference in Saudi Arabia where there were global leaders and where the subject of UFOs was discussed. We'll be back right after this.
Come on.
My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman, and as I said at the top of this show, before the break, there's probably absolutely not a single individual in the world of UFOs who is unfamiliar with the name Stanton Friedman. We are delighted to have him back with us. It's always fun when he's here. Stanton, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Glad to be on again. Why not?
It's late where you are, I know that, and I certainly appreciate you being up so late to be with us. But you've spent quite a number of hours in travel here lately. You've just returned from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I also was down in Atlanta last week, but two weeks before that, I was in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, for a most unusual conference. Something that came as a shock when I first heard about it last June. I was invited to the GCF, Global Competitiveness Forum number 5, sponsored by the Arabian General Investment Authority. Now, when I first got that invitation, I did some checking because I wasn't sure there was any such thing. I thought somebody was pulling my leg. I'd never heard of it. But it turns out it's legitimate. And after discussions, they were talking about having a panel on innovation and UFOs, would you believe? And this is as I checked into it, I found this is a major world, big shot conference, if you will. Bill Gates was their first keynote speaker 5 years ago. And the speaker this year, as it turned out, in January, was Bill Clinton. And former Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien was there as a panelist. Also, Tony Blair was there, and almost 1,000 people and over 100 participants on panels or speeches or whatever. Lasted 3 days, and they were the wheelers and dealers of the world. It cost $4,000 to attend this thing. I didn't have to pay that. I wasn't getting paid either, but.
Well, okay, now look, who it takes $4,000 to buy a ticket, and plus you have your travel expenses if you attend this conference. So who's attending?
Big shots. The chief test pilot for Boeing, the head of Google and IBM vice presidents and all kinds of titles that make sense as well. I was having lunch one day, and one of the other guys at the table were talking. He was an investment guy. There were several themes. Innovation was a major one, but they were looking in education, they were looking in medicine, they were looking in investment, risk-taking, all this kind of thing, and trying to build a world in which there would be jobs for Saudi Arabians, educating their women, all this kind of thing. Anyway, I'm at lunch, and the guy's with an investment firm, and I casually asked how much money they invest. Oh, about $150 billion.
Yeah, pocket change.
That's kind of an impressive number, frankly. I mean, it was at a 4-star hotel, Four Seasons in Riyadh and stuff, and they sent us, we traveled first class, and, it was well done, and the panel had 5 people on it. It only lasted for 75 minutes. It's a long way to go for 75 minutes work time, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
The other 4 panelists, and it was contact with outer space, basically, originally innovation and UFOs. Innovation was the major theme of the conference. But the other participants were Dr. Michio Kaku, a string theorist and astrophysicist from New York. And he was focused on observing civilizations type 1, 2, or 3. A Russian named Kardashev way back in the 60s had said, an advanced civilization is going to either use all the energy of the planet, that's not well defined, or all the energy of a solar system, or all the energy of a galaxy. and we're a type zero. I mean, that was 1, 2, 3, and we should be looking for these. This is entirely a theoretical construct. Nobody knows if any such civilizations exist. I'm dubious about, we're not certainly in a galaxy in which somebody is using all the energy of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would know about that. Nick Pope was one of the participants from England. Nick worked for the Ministry of Defense and was at the UFO desk for 3 years, way back several years ago. And he writes a lot of articles. He was focused on several different ways of looking for extraterrestrials. SETI, you know, this silly effort to investigate, my least favorite, but I better not say that. astrophysicist looking at astrobiology, I guess you'd call it, trying to find bacteria hither and yon and what conditions make for life, and recognizing that we've got extremophiles all over the place. In other words, our notions of where life could exist have been changed drastically by finding life in all kinds of places we didn't expect to find any life, you know, down in Antarctica and in rocks and under very high temperature conditions at the bottom of the ocean where there is no light. Everybody mm-hmm. knew light was needed for life, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the astrobiologists are cruising along. And, of course, these two groups don't talk to the ufologists because that's not science, you know. We're worried about real beings from out there coming here. And the scientists want to deal with things that don't have intervention by intelligence.
Well, that way they're not challenged, you see. That way, see, as long as they stick their head in the sand and don't admit that there's intelligent extraterrestrial life, they can't be challenged by any extraterrestrial life out there that is smarter and more technologically advanced than themselves.
Yeah, and who hasn't stopped by to ask to have lunch with them, you know, or landed on the White House lawn.
Mm-hmm.
Another participant was Dr. Jacques Vallée. Now, he's one of the early bird real scholars of ufology, if you will, even though he's younger than I am. His first book was written, 40 years ago, something like that. And Jacques is a PhD, but he is an investment counselor as well, which seemed very appropriate for this conference. And he has a new book out with Chris Albeck, A-U-B-E-C-K, 500 sightings from about 1400 B.C., to 1879. So we know that none of these were airplanes, helicopters, man-made rockets, et cetera, et cetera. Jacques said there's a very robust case to be made for evidence of something very interesting going on. He wouldn't really quite say that there were extraterrestrial visiting, but he certainly left that open as one possible explanation for these strange events. And then there was me. And unlike the others, of course, as you know, I took a stand. That's, a keynote of my activities is once you've studied the heck out of a subject and you've reached conclusions, you ought to state what they are. And so I did. I started off by saying, after 53 years of study, I'm convinced that the evidence is overwhelming that planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. In other words, some UFOs are alien spacecraft. I said there's full, complete evidence of there being a cosmic Watergate, meaning some countries know a great deal more that they're not telling us about what's going on. I pointed out if you want to study, you want to do innovative things, study those things which have already obviously done that. So looking at the behavior of UFOs, we could find out a lot about maybe interstellar travel in the atmosphere, how to move at high speeds without burning up, et cetera, et cetera. You're much more likely to find something new if you study something that's already done it than if you start from scratch. And so we went on for 75 minutes. Oh, the fifth person was an Arabian scholar. He's from Egypt, actually, but he's a professor. And he brought in the Quran and rather reluctantly admitted there's nothing in the Quran that says there isn't life, intelligent life in outer space, but he thought it was too far away. Now, as far as I could tell, none of these people besides me had seriously looked at the question of interstellar travel by investigation as opposed to by proclamation. I worked on fusion propulsion systems, and I did show pictures of a nuclear rocket engine. One of the Los Alamos ones operated at 4,400 megawatts, that's twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam. It was less than 7 feet in diameter. I talked about nuclear fusion, and if you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. And so I summarized my views by the notion that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. Lasers aren't just better light bulbs, in other words. So it was, we sat on a stage, big, lovely stage. At times the room had many hundreds of people. The women were segregated a bit from the men, but there were some women mixed in the men, too. And one of the things that impressed me about the trip, it was clear that Saudi Arabia is trying to educate its women. There were women presenters, heads of medical research and so forth. And that's rather unusual for the Muslim world. And so it was a great conference. No, I didn't get to meet Bill Clinton or Tony Blair.
I know you're heartbroken.
Well,
see, I'm one up on you. I've shaken Bill Clinton's hand.
Well, I haven't. I wash my hands. I don't know if you do, but... I have met Jimmy Carter, incidentally.
Yeah, I've met Bill Clinton two times. But
nice guy?
Do what?
Was he a nice guy?
Well, he's Bill Clinton. You know, I've never seen Bill when he didn't have his politician mask on, and never seen him when he didn't have the act going on.
He gave a very good talk, incidentally. Mm-hmm. He's a fine speaker. I would suspect he got paid $100,000 or $200,000 to be there. I don't know, but I didn't get paid anything, so it's okay. I'm not jealous. After I'm president, then they'll pay me.
Well, he might not have got paid anything. He gets several million dollars, I think. I've seen that from Saudi Arabia for his foundation. He's gotten several million. So maybe they thought, hey, you owe us one.
He is a guy who has made a real effort to help the people of the world. And it's one of the points I made sometime along the way, that from an alien viewpoint, where a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare, this year we will spend over $1 trillion on things military, and 30,000 children die every single day of starvation or preventable disease.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of the guys who has turned his name power, if you will, like all the drugs for HIV and stuff like that, appreciate that. We should be spending more on helping those who can't help themselves through no fault of their own. The kids with HIV in Africa are a good example of that. Anyway, the conference was an eye-opener for me. I got a note just the other day suggesting, telling me the dates of next year's conference, and hoping I can come again. Now, that wasn't an invitation, so I'm not sure. I'm not about to spend $4,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, was the overall theme of this conference, the overall theme of the whole conference, was it pretty much pro-globalism?
Yeah, but learning the lessons that we should have learned a long time ago, that is, everybody was asking me, so what is Saudi Arabia with all its oil doing with a global competitiveness forum? What do they care? Well, they're trying to avoid, I would say, what just happened in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
The Muslim world is a high birth rate and low opportunity rate. There's a lot of poverty, and there's not much education, especially for women. So the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is spending 25% of its budget on education. They've built three huge educational institutions. They have really made an effort to attract foreign capital and jumped from like 48th in the world to 8th. Very proud of that. And they've learned some of the lessons. It was stressed. There was a whole session on risk and failure. Almost every successful entrepreneur has had a failure or two someplace in his background. And in some societies, once you've had a failure, that's it. Forget it. In others, hey, let's get back at it. I can do this anyway, you know. So the whole theme was we need to do more in this world to move the world in such a way that there are more jobs, more education, therefore more food, more opportunity.
So, yeah, I understand. But so then I'm curious as to why they plugged in a panel about UFOs.
Well, if you're going to look at somebody who's been innovative, it's clearly the aliens have been more innovative than we have when it comes to propulsion system design and traipsing around the galactic neighborhood and things like that.
So would this be a recognition by the conference, a recognition of the reality of these extraterrestrial civilizations?
They didn't make a statement like that, but I would say be close to saying yes. I had a lot of comment from people afterward, you know, because we were around, the panelists were around. The panel was on Sunday, and we were there until Tuesday night. And so you'd meet people at coffee breaks, at lunch, and at dinner. And everybody who came up to me said nice things, like they were surprised that there was such a panel, but they thought it was a good idea, and they enjoyed it. And I had a nice note from the organizer that this panel was a highlight of the conference. And so these are guys who have their eyes open about trying to move forward in whatever direction they're working, you know, whether it's education or medicine. Or
did you get a sense from talking with these people that these global movers and shakers... Now, we've got a break coming up, so I'll just ask the question, and then we'll get your response after the break. But did you get a sense from these global movers and shakers that this was something new to them? Or did you get a sense that, they were pretty much on board with the UFO information and were just a little bit surprised that it was right out there in the open on top of the table, so to speak, at this very prestigious conference at Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman. And Stan, before we went to break, I had asked a question. Did you get a sense from talking with these global movers and shakers that they were just beginning to wake up to the reality of UFOs and extraterrestrials? Or did you get a sense that they were already sort of keyed in on this?
I would say it was a cross between the two. I had the sense that they were not surprised that governments can cover up data. Mm-hmm. I showed two CIA UFO documents that it took me 5 years to get where you could read 8 words per page. They didn't seem to be shocked when I said that we have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that can operate for 18 years without refueling. Now, when you get past those things, these people seem to be realistic, and I just had the feeling that, well, okay, no big deal. Look at the progress we've made in the last 50 years. So somebody a little bit ahead of us is probably able to do all kinds of things that we can't do. And, you know, when you're sitting in today's world, you sort of take for granted the Internet, all those computers, the Blackberries, the, you know, all the crazy technology we have that would have seemed totally out of, you know, out of reality 50 years ago. But these people have all watched how our reality has changed drastically. So adding another factor, visits by aliens a bit ahead of us, didn't seem to scare them. It didn't seem to be shocking. It's kind of, well, I probably always thought there was somebody out there coming here. So there didn't seem to be a shock factor. Now, I'm not saying there weren't any people who were totally opposed to the notion for religious reasons, if no others. But it was kind of an unusual feeling to be amongst people who, no big deal. I mean, this is without my giving my normal 90-minute lecture, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I would not be surprised at all if after I gave my usual Flying Saucers Are Real lecture that most of the people in the audience would buy into it because I present all kinds of data. Well, when you got about less than 10 minutes to talk, you know, you don't have a chance to make that powerful case. But I just had the feeling that they were accepting and interested and aware this could be a major change in what's going on.
Was there any resistance to the information? Did anybody voice to you any kind of resistance?
There was a question from somebody who said, well, what do you have besides anecdotal data? I had mentioned that, look, there are five large-scale scientific studies that I talk about in my lectures and that I find, because I ask, that fewer than 2% of the people in the audience have read any of them. So somebody asked about anecdotal data, and I said, well, we're well beyond that stage with these five large-scale studies, with the 4,000 physical trace cases from Ted Phillips, with a number of abduction cases, that, you know, it isn't a question of anecdotes anymore. We're not talking about lights in the sky, multiple witness radar visual cases, the testimony of scientists to Congress back in the late 60s, and then we went on to something else. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, there were some religious, it was funny how many people were quoting the Quran, but yeah, a couple who were saying, well, there's nothing there, and others who said, well, if you look at this verse, and you look at this verse, this sounds like there are others out there. That was intriguing, the religious aspect. But I didn't hear, and I asked them. I said, look, people said nice things to me, but I would expect if they didn't like the fact that you had such a panel, I sent this to the organizers, that they would have said it to you, not to me. Did you get complaints? I asked that flat out, and the answer was no, they didn't, that it was a very well-received panel. And so I was pleased about that. Because, like I said, there's a certain bias. You're not going to walk up to somebody you're sitting down for lunch with and say, gee, he did a lousy job. I don't think that's true. You know, you're not going to say that. These aren't those kinds of people, I would say. They're not the ancient academics and fossilized physicists who inhabit the anti-UFO world of the debunkers. Didn't see signs of that. There were a few people who weren't aware of the data, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let me play the devil's advocate for just a moment. You have well documented the UFO Watergate, the cosmic Watergate. You've well documented its existence, and I don't think, especially people in the United States, the ones who are not mushrooms and who have actually burned up a few gray cells thinking about this, they have no doubt that there has been and is an ongoing cover-up of UFO information. Okay, among that group, and it's a very sizable group in the United States, there are a great many people who think that there's a very real possibility of a coming false flag operation in which the U.S. government, for whatever reasons, is going to try and convince people that the Earth is under attack by extraterrestrials, and the end result being, but we're going to protect you, and they do it by martial law and taking over, abrogating the few remaining shreds of the Constitution, and then we have martial law. Now, in order for such a false flag operation to succeed, I would think like me, you would have to have the global movers and shakers on board, not necessarily with a false flag operation, but on board with accepting UFOs and ETs as a reality. What would you say about that?
Well, yeah, that's certainly a possibility, and that's been talked about. This coming week, I will hear Carol Rawson, who worked with Wernher von Braun, who worried about things like that. And I'll be anxious to see. I met her a number of years ago, heard her speak. I'll see if anything much has changed. And as a matter of fact, in just today's news, there was something about talk about the government trying to have the power to shut down the Internet.
Oh, my friend, we've been talking about that here for months.
Okay. So what I'm saying is these things are always a possibility. Mm-hmm. And I just got a book by Dr. John Alexander, who says, well, there really isn't any cover-up. There are a lot of people. He's asked hither, thither, and yon. He was a military guy, and he was had high-level security clearances and so forth. And he could find no signs that there really was any data out there. And I just did a quick look. You know, I do a funny thing when I get a book on UFOs. I look in the index for my name, things, to see what and Roswell and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and to see how the reaction is. And so I read his treatment of the Cutler Twining memo, one of the MJ-12 documents, and he really missed the boat. And what I've said, there'll be a new book coming out from my publisher, Career Press, within a few months, a number of individual articles. It's a synthesis of a lot of people's articles, a combination of them. And in it, I have an article about national security and UFOs. And I point out that one of the most useful weapons to anybody in government who wants to keep secrets is the egos of the insiders. If that were true, I would know about it, is the attitude. And I mm-hmm. haven't seen any signs that it was true, and I certainly don't know anything about it, therefore it isn't true. Because mm-hmm. I'm so important that they would let me know. And I think that's a great protection, because they don't seem to understand that. Why would they know? The whole point of a need to know is to keep people who don't have a need to know from knowing. And, you know, that's the way security really works. And so it's more likely that John is working for somebody than that there's a false flag operation. He's working for somebody who is anxious to show that there is no cover-up. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how you keep the public from, and the press especially. How many press guys want to admit that, hey, we've ignored the biggest story of the millennium for more than 60 years, alien visitations? And one thing I looked up in the index, I haven't read the book, I just got it, picked it up today from my post office box in beautiful downtown Houlton, Maine. I haven't read it, but I looked up, for example, Carol Bolander, General Bolander, whose memo says that reports which could affect national security, reports of UFOs, which could affect national security, are made in accordance with Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146 or Air Force Manual 55-11 and are not part of the Blue Book system. His job was to see what should we do about Project Blue Book, and it was canceled as a result of his memo.
Well, that's an admission, isn't it?
What?
That's an admission that there are. It admits there are reports. Yeah, see, that's an admission that there are reports of UFO incidents that do have national security implications.
Yeah, very definitely. I located him and spoke to him on the phone. He's dead now. You can't call him again to check, but I did talk to him. And I said, that sounds like you're saying there's a two-pronged system, if you will, that the reports which could affect security go through this path, and the other ones go through that path. And he said, yes. Now, I noticed that John Alexander doesn't mention that. And so I'm not saying the Blue Book people knew what was going on. I'm saying that Carol Bolander, who was a two-star Air Force general, who was given the job of looking into the situation, what should we do, he noted two paragraphs after the quote that I gave that if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a government place to report sightings to. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the procedures established for that purpose. Now, that's blatantly saying, you know, if a saucer goes down the runway at a SAC base where nuclear weapons are stored, that's a national security case. Blue Book doesn't get those. They're not involved in national security. You know, if you and I stand out at the end of my driveway and freeze our butts off this time of year, where I live anyway, and see a UFO fly over, no big deal. People see them fly over all over the place all the time. So what I'm saying is I'm anxious to read this book, but I've already found some things that make me seriously question the conclusions, because they're based on not digging deep enough or not admitting that despite all the clearances he's had at one time or another, hither and yon, he doesn't really know what's going on, or if he does, he's not telling us. So he could be an agent, if you will, of the powers that be.
Well, I'll tell you this, that's not the first time that I've heard someone say that. I don't have any personal knowledge as to whether John Alexander is an active disinformation agent, but I have heard people say that they think he is. That doesn't prove the point, but it certainly there are quite a few suspicions that swirl about the name of Mr. Alexander. We have to step away for a break, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Stanton Friedman. Stanton, let's step back just a moment to the organizers of this conference. During the break, a thought hit me. You know, we sort of went from the possibility of false flag, and then we went to this book by John Alexander, and talking about possibility of disinformation and so forth. So let's go back to the organizers of this conference. Do you know who the organizers were? And specifically, were there any CFR or trilateral commission members that were part of the organizing panel for the conference?
Not that I know of. Of course, I'm not a real expert on the trilateral commission or, you know, the... There's several other organizations that they put in the same box. The head of the World Bank was there, I believe. But the basic organization structure was the Saudi Arabia, SAGIA, S-A-G-I-A, Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority. They're the ones who are trying to upgrade the status of the Saudi Arabian kingdom to make it a world in which I suppose the concern is nobody will cause to happen what happened in Egypt and what's going on right now in what? Jordan, Tunis, Libya, there are several other Arabian
countries. Algiers, Bahrain.
Yeah.
It's breaking out all over. Okay,
yeah,
now,
and
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Incidentally, one aspect of that that couldn't have happened not too many years ago was the major role that the Internet played, and you can see that by the fact that government tried to turn it off. And so we live in a different world now, and you can say revolutionaryism, if you will, or overthrowing of despots, or how long has Gaddafi been in power? I think 40 years, something like that.
I think his countdown clock is running.
I think that this is true around the world. Remember what happened to East Germany when the Berlin Wall came down?
Yeah.
There again, it was information. When the people there saw what was going on outside, and they had been lulled into the, this is the best of all possible worlds, and it isn't. You know, there was a real shocker. But power to the people, you know, it sounds like an old slogan, which it is, but if you have communication and a way of getting those people with a common feeling about things together, these kinds of things can happen. And, you know, the new day is dawning, somebody once said that, and it seems to be the case. And as I say, it would seem so interesting to me that the Egyptian thing happened as I came back from Saudi Arabia, and you suddenly realized, hey, they're trying to avoid that, and I don't blame them. And so whether the trilateral guys were there or not, I don't know. But it's pretty hard to keep the people down once they are able to find out what's happening with other, and that there are so many other people. If you think you're in the minority, gee, I'm the only one who thinks this, I better not say anything. This is what happens with UFOs. In one survey I did in a classroom, 80% thought people did not believe, most people did not believe that any UFOs were extraterrestrial spacecraft. 80% of that very same group did think that some UFOs were aliens.
But they were of the opinion that they were in the minority.
And so that's what constrains activity. And so that's why it's so important, things like what Robert Hastings is doing with nukes and UFOs, you know, getting people aware. And that's where it's so important of what the media does. And maybe your listeners aren't aware of how much the press was co-opted by the CIA way back in the 70s. The Church Committee pointed that out.
Yeah.
And I just talked to somebody who was a mover and shaker in ufology and apparently was the target of a really vicious attack from Philip Klass a number of years ago. And I, there is available via the internet a file on Phil's papers, and his FBI file has been published. And when you see what a vicious attack he made on Dr. J. Allen Hynek, and which was rebuffed by the FBI, incidentally, to their credit. But he sent a letter to the Canadian government. I didn't know about this. This was in 1980. I didn't know about it until 25 years later, warning them that I was going to be coming here and trying to make them look foolish and blah, 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 blah. Now, you wonder. He says he never took any money from the government. That doesn't mean there was no money changing hands going to his favorite charity or to somebody else or whatever. You know, or in his infinite, he didn't need a lot of money. He was doing pretty well. He was single until he was 60, and he got married to avoid debating me in New York.
That's desperation.
That actually happened. We were supposed to debate, and he couldn't make it because he was getting married.
Okay, well, see, now, his name has come up a lot as a possible disinformation agent as well.
Yeah.
We've got about 3.5 minutes here till break. So let me dive back into this false flag thing now. What we're hearing out there, and I know you've heard it, is that it's called Project Bluebeam. Do you have any idea as to whether, because I know you've dug into all kinds of records and stuff over the years, do you have any idea as to whether there's any validity to this Project Bluebeam rumor? And if so, where did this information originate?
I don't know. I'd put it in my gray basket. I've heard the term. I don't know anything about it really worth talking about. I will say this. The beauty of communication systems is they can be used for good or for evil.
Mm-hmm.
You can spread garbage around, and Lord knows there's a lot of it out there. I know that there are people who said, I'm a disinformation agent, and I'm trying to figure out, where does that come from? And the vivid imagination of people like Milton William Cooper is all I can think of. You remember the late Mr. Cooper?
Yes.
As I tell people, yes, I did once work for the government, 2 weeks for the United States Post Office in Linden, New Jersey, when I was a sophomore at Rutgers University in 1952. I did work for the government, delivering mail. And I was using my ROTC shoes because otherwise my feet were killing me. That's it, you know. And so I get a kick out of it, but I don't know who starts rumors like that and who starts. And I don't know about Bluebeam. It's come up recently several times, and I haven't had a chance to really dig into it. But, you know, what I found, one of the things I found is that somehow if people see it in writing on the Internet, it must be true.
Yeah.
And there's a cachet that goes with it just being out there. They wouldn't have said that if it wasn't true. I've had people tell me that about newspapers. And I say, you've got to be kidding. I remember early on when I was working as a nuclear physicist at General Electric on nuclear airplanes, there was an article in the paper saying some people had made a real great breakthrough in radiation shielding, and I was carpooling with two other engineers, and I pointed out that this was ludicrous. I read the article. They wouldn't have printed it if it wasn't true. And so I called the guy who was mentioned in the article. He was very apologetic. He was supposed to get a look at the article before it was published, and he didn't. And it was full of baloney, just as I suspected. But I was shocked. Here were two educated people presuming that the press was so responsible that they wouldn't print anything if it weren't true.
Well, the press is responsible. They are responsible for most of the fiction and lies that people believe are true.
Yes.
There are some excellent reporters, but I've watched this happen. Excellent reporters that file reports that have the facts and the data. And by the time it makes it to print or by the time it makes it to air, everything's been changed, and it doesn't resemble what they wrote or what they recorded. I know a reporter from when I was in Kosovo, and I watched that happen. I know what he filed, and then when it came out on, I won't mention the, I don't want to get him in trouble. I won't mention but it was very, very well-known news on television. When it came out, it did not even resemble what he had written, and it was fiction. So when I talk about the press and talk about the media and what scurrilous dogs they are, I'm not talking about all of the reporters.
No, of course.
I'm talking about whoever it is that decides the end product that we get. All right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll be back right after this. welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Stanton Friedman. Now, for those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're delighted you're here. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever kept you from the first hour, because we have been discussing the Big Shot Conference, I guess you could say, the Global Movers and Shakers, that just met in Saudi Arabia, and included in that conference was a panel that had to do with things out in space, extraterrestrial, UFOs. Stanton Friedman was a member of the panel, and we've been talking about that. And I'm going to open up the telephone lines in just a moment, but I have yet another question about this conference before we open the panel. Stan, when you step back and you look at this conference now, and I mean from the vantage point of you've been there, you've done that, you got to meet some of these people, some of these movers and shakers. Do you get the impression from this that this is sort of programming them, that this was intended to sort of program them into acceptance? Or do you get the feeling that this was just something they thought would be interesting?
Well, frankly, my first thought was that it reminded me exactly of my thought when I heard of what the Pope had said a couple years back about God could have made our brethren in outer space just as he made us. No mm-hmm. big deal. And my first reaction was, what does he know that we don't know? Is he trying to get the world's billion Catholics, you know, to be on board for when the big announcement gets made? I certainly had, my first impression was maybe these guys know something, and they know it's going to, one of the big areas that are going to change will be economics. For example, what if these guys have been stealing gold, you know, Zechariah Sitchin kind of thing, for years? The Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. Everybody would know that out there. And there are asteroids that are loaded with metals. What if they've been mining the goodies from here, and it shocks people when I say, you know what uranium was used for 100 years ago? Yellow glaze on pottery for your dining room table. I mean, not very valuable, in other words. Now we know that the Earth has lots of rare things that are very valuable and that are more likely to be here, certainly, than any other place in the solar system because we're so dense. You know, Saturn is so light, if you had a big enough bucket of water, it would float. Saturn would. So I don't know. My thinking is that they're moving in that direction of recognition that this will be one of those singular events when, and I'm working on a paper now, as a matter of fact, for the MUFON conference coming up in the end of July in Irvine, California, about are we ready for contact with aliens. And when you start to think about that a bit, we got some serious problems we have to look at before we're ready. We don't have anybody who speaks for planet Earth. That's what's so silly about all those, why don't they land on a White House lawn kind of thing. You know, how absurd. In the first place, it's a no-fly zone. In the second place, rules on Earth are shoot first, ask questions later. In the third place, the President of the United States does not speak for 6.7 billion Earthlings. There's nobody who speaks for us all. So why would you land on a White House lawn? You know, it makes no sense. There are big questions here. Also, if there really are aliens coming here and they don't like us monkeying around with nuclear weapons, which they seem not to, which are also a sign of control of a lot of energy, which would get us to be able to bother them out there, they would be concerned about Earthlings. I think from their viewpoint, a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. just look what goes on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I won't have time in my paper at MUFON to cover all the ways in which the other advanced civilizations in the neighborhood would be concerned about the people on this planet. We're primitives.
We are.
Any civilization that's lasted a lot longer than we have will have solved some of the problems that we don't know how to solve. How do we live at peace with each other? How do we keep from beating the heck out of the planet? You know, it's not just nuclear weapons, but our biological and trade and poverty, and there's a whole bunch of problems here.
Well, yeah, but now, you know, I'm not so sure that just because they have high tech that they have high spirituality and high morality. If you compare, compare us to the people living on the day when the Wright brothers first flew at Kitty Hawk, compare us to that civilization at that time, you would have to say that technologically we are extremely advanced compared to that civilization. But the evidence is that advancements in technology did not equal advancements in spirituality and morality. We're still killing each other. We just do it more inventively.
Well, you're right, and that's the kicker. Either you learn to live at peace with your neighbors, which is much more difficult when you've got both got weapons of mass destruction, or you succumb to what happens naturally. I drop a bomb, you drop a bomb. Pretty soon, we're all bombed out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my argument, partly, is that if they got here, they went through this stage of too much technology and not enough sociology, which certainly describes us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, standing back and looking at this planet, all you can do is shake your head and say, these guys are crazy. The figure of $1 trillion a year on things military and not being able to feed 30,000 children who die every single day, there's something wrong with that. And if somebody starts a war, we'll be back to the Stone Age.
Mm-hmm. So, well, yeah, I see what you're saying. And one would hope, I hope, that your analysis of that is spot on. I do.
But if
I look at us and use us as an example, I'd have to say, well, we advanced a lot technologically, but we're still barbarians. I want to open up the telephone line and allow our audience to participate.
Okay.
Folks, the telephones are open, and the telephone number is 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. If you need to call me toll-free in the USA and Canada, I do have a toll-free number. It is 888-223-4599. If you can call me without it costing you long distance, then please don't use the toll-free number. Use the main number. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can call our main number and we'd be very glad to talk with you. Delighted to talk with you, as a matter of fact. But if you are outside the USA and you're outside of Canada and you don't want to make that international long-distance call, then you can go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show, and to the right of that picture is a link that says Flash Message. That's only for outside the USA and outside of Canada because I don't have a toll-free number for out there. To the telephone, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Tony from Denver.
Hello, Tony.
I have two questions for you, Mr. Friedman.
Yep.
My first is about the Phoebus engine you worked on. An aircraft carrier could go 18 years without refueling. Mr. Friedman, what about the Phoebus nuclear engine? How far can you go out into space before it needs refueling? Has any country ever put a nuclear rocket into space? If not, why?
Okay, give him a chance to answer.
Okay, the Phoebus reactor, it's not a question of refueling. It heats hydrogen. Hydrogen goes in, liquid hydrogen, very, very cold. It gets heated in the reactor to over 4,000 degrees and gets exhausted through the nozzle. That's how the system works, basically. And you wouldn't use it to lift the system from the Earth. You'd use it as an upper stage. For example, if you go to Mars, you can double or triple the payload if you use a nuclear rocket engine instead of a chemical rocket engine. For really deep space travel, you'd go to nuclear fusion. And no, we haven't operated one out in deep space. To get back to your initial question, they've been operated on the surface of the Earth. And when it came time to fish or cut bait, NASA cut bait. They didn't have anybody with the guts to use the system. The worst meeting I ever was at in my life when I was in industry, Space Nuclear Propulsion Office of NASA, I was working for Westinghouse Astronuclear. I was at Aerojet General, which was also working on nuclear rockets. And my cohort out there, my colleague out there, asked if I wanted to go to the meeting. I said, sure. And the question of the meeting is, what should we do with this nuclear rocket? And they listed a half a dozen different possibilities. Well, the public won't go for this, or maybe we could do that, maybe we could do... There wasn't the slightest bit of leadership. Now, to go back to the nuclear aircraft carrier that can operate for 18 years without refueling, that's where Admiral Rickover came into the picture. Nuclear submarine, 1956, the Nautilus, and then onward. And there were all kinds of people who said, don't build nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, don't build nuclear-powered submarines, build battleships! Anyway, Rickover was a leader. He knew where he wanted to go, and you weren't going to stay on his train unless you wanted to go to the same place. And I've worked on at least four other programs that desperately needed somebody like Admiral Rickover. Fusion is where you get to deep space, that is, to other star systems, because you can kick particles out that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as you can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. And it's much more efficient than nuclear rockets. But before we go to other stars, we're probably going to want to go to Mars, for example. And there, a nuclear upper stage, a third stage, would be very useful. So we use the term nuclear, but they're really very different reactors. It's a water-cooled one on the aircraft carrier. And the way they can go for 18 years is they have what are called burnable poisons, materials that absorb neutrons. And they get burned up as the fuel gets burned up. So the ratio of fissionable materials to the rest of the stuff stays pretty much the same for a very long period of time. Very clever engineers. The point is that progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way, but it's expensive. And I think I've said this before on the program when I was working on nuclear airplanes. We operated jet engines on nuclear power, but we didn't operate an airplane on nuclear power. We've carried reactors on board airplanes, but they didn't power the airplanes. But if you were, when I was working on nuclear airplanes, in 1958, we were spending $100 million and employed, this is General Electric, and employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. That was a lot of money back then.
That would equate to about $1.2 billion today.
Yeah, something like that. It's mm-hmm. not chicken change or chump change for me, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And my point is that I get the ancient academics and fossilized physicists who don't seem to understand that there's a lot of research and development going on outside of academia. It costs much, much, much money. The stealth fighter was developed at a cost of $10 billion over 10 years. So I cannot design for them a system, you know, I'll get back to you next week and then we can build it. That's not how it works. And, you know, you can make little stuff that works, but you want something big like an interstellar rocket, it's going to cost a lot of dough. And we have to be realistic about that. And so when I mention these things, what I'm saying is we know enough to say, and the aliens know we know enough because they have seen the first H-bomb was a 3-mile-wide fireball. which produced as much energy as exploding 10 million tons of TNT. Now, that's not a good way to get you to the stars, but if you use the process in a more controlled fashion, you can do it. If you want to spend the money and use all the people it would take to develop such a system. And my own feeling is we shouldn't do it unless we have a planetary interstellar vehicle. I can't imagine a Galactic Federation allowing memberships from individual countries any more than the United Nations accepts representatives from individual cities. It's an inappropriate unit, in other words.
Mm-hmm. Tony, did you have another question?
Yes, please.
Go ahead.
You have said in the past aliens would have learned and understood a lot more than us on the subject of reincarnation. Do you yourself believe in this idea of one lifetime after another? And how could an understanding of reincarnation help a space-traveling civilization?
I personally do indeed believe that there's a whole bunch of errors, reincarnation being one, of what we today call paranormal phenomena, remote viewing, telepathy, stuff like that, being able to take people through walls. I think that's pretty neat. I don't know how to do it, though. So I think that they probably do know how to do these things, and I doubt if they're going to tell us. Just as I don't expect them to hand us a nuclear fusion rocket either, any more than I would give a loaded gun to my 3-year-old great-grandson.
But do you buy the idea of reincarnation?
Yes, but it's not a one-to-one kind of thing. I think there's a lot of good work that's been done. What's his name? Stevenson. Collecting stories of people whose memories clearly indicate they were somebody else somewhere else at a different time. I think it's real. It doesn't mean it's controllable. It doesn't mean everyone does. I don't know the mechanisms. Mm-hmm. It's an area in which we haven't spent the effort to find out because we know that can't possibly be because it's unscientific to think of that, you know.
But conceptually, even though you don't know all the mechanics of it, conceptually you don't have a problem with it.
No.
Yeah.
I don't.
All right, to the telephone.
People, and I'm sorry.
Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Ryan in Puget Sound.
Yeah, Ryan.
Hey, do you guys remember back in October when we heard that 50 ICBMs at F.E. Warren had a computer glitch and suddenly went offline? Do you guys remember that?
Yep.
Yeah.
This October? Well, apparently, this is from, I got a on an email list from Robert Hastings that he's been getting all kinds of witness accounts directed towards him. People who, down in Nebraska, the panhandle, that saw large cigar shapes over the base, and he's having police down there send him the reports. And he spent 4 days down there, and apparently there were a lot of UFOs sighted over that area when that happened.
It does.
So this is kind of interesting because it's so recent.
Yeah, I've heard about that. I haven't seen the results of his final report, if you will, but because Bob has gone public and has had the good fortune to have some very sharp people go public with him at that conference in Washington and elsewhere, he's become a lightning rod for people who have a story to tell but who haven't known who to tell it to. You know, that's one of the things about security. Once everybody decides that, hey, we all got to talk, then it's very hard to single one out and make an example of him so nobody will talk. And I've often thought that if we could get the government to say, well, okay, anybody who's talking about something that happened 50 years ago, amnesty, you know, and then pretty soon it's going to be 40, 20, 10, 5. you know, segregation was broken by doing it 1 year at a time in some school systems. You know, this year first grade, next year first and second grade, and then pretty soon it's all desegregated, without having made too much of a fuss. And so I'm glad that Bob is out there, and Salas and others, and the fact that they're getting this kind of a response is very, very good. I was kind of a lightning rod for people about Roswell for a while, because they didn't know anybody was interested and that anybody else had spoken out. And, you know, we need more situations like that and more people with Bob's guts.
More people with what?
Listening, I'd like to hear, and I'll pass it on to Bob.
Yeah, okay.
My website is www.stantonfriedman.com, and it tells you how to reach me, and my email address is, FSPHYS, Flying Saucer Physicist, at rogers.com. And I don't use witness names without permission. And if you happen to have a piece of Roswell wreckage, let me know. We'll get it analyzed. Without revealing your name, of course.
You know, when you have a group of people that come out and talk, as they did at this press conference with Robert Hastings, it is conceivable that it's, you know, it's possible that the government could take action against all of those guys, but it's not possible to do so without proving to everyone who heard them that what they had to say was true. The instant they move against these guys, it proves to everyone that what they had to say was true.
Yeah.
And
the government's in a tough situation. But we don't realize it yet.
Well, yeah, the government is in a tough situation. And, you know, I'm pretty outspoken and pretty tough about UFO secrecy. And yet at the same time, I have said, and I continue to maintain, they may know something about these craft that would be very, very dangerous to us technologically if it got into the wrong hands, got into the hands of enemies.
I have said I don't want technical details out on the table. Suppose we have figured out a better way of detecting flight of something in the atmosphere besides radar. Should we put that out on the table where Osama bin Laden can get it, or whoever? There are a lot of other bad guys out there.
Mm-hmm.
No. And people look at me, you don't think we're entitled to know everything? No, I don't. I worked under security for 14 years. And sure, there are some stupid things that are made classified. I don't doubt that. But I've seen some. But as a general rule, there is national security information. You don't give your enemies your technology.
Mm-hmm.
And when he can put it together with what he has learned. And when I say your enemies, we live in a world in which everybody has enemies.
Sure. You
know, India and Pakistan, for example, are not exactly friendly to each other. And there are a whole bunch, the United States and the Soviet Union, and there's a whole bunch of enmities out there.
Well, you know, the Soviet Union's gone.
Yeah.
It's us and Russia. But you're right. We have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Get your fingers ready to do the dialing, because we'll have the phone lines open again when we come back. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman. And the telephone lines, ladies and gentlemen, are open. If you wish to call and participate in tonight's show, you may do so. We invite you to do so. 623-444-5889 is the main number here in the studio. Toll free in the USA and Canada, 888-223-4599. And, of course, if you're outside the USA and you're outside of Canada and you wish to participate without making an international long-distance call, you can go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, look on the right side of that picture about tonight's show, and you'll see the link that says Flash Message. If you're outside of the USA and Canada, that's for you, okay? Or you can call the main number. We'll be glad to hear you. Stanton, let me get you to take us to Atlanta for a moment. You just came back from Atlanta as well. Well, yeah. What was that all about?
Well, it was supposedly a truth conference. It's the first time they've had one, a truth con. You know how sci-fi conventions are cons.
Yeah.
And I won't try to make the obvious pun out of that. But I gave a talk, and there were a couple of talks on UFOs. But there was one guy who, well, he was the libertarian candidate for president in the last election. He gave 2 4-hour presentations about the U.S. Constitution, would you believe? I don't know what that has to do with all this stuff, but there was a guy named Tellinger.
Yeah, Michael Tellinger.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed his presentation. He's a fine speaker, and he's written a couple of books, and I have 2 of his books. I haven't read them yet, but I was just there. And about life in South Africa, these remains, remnants of cities from hundreds of thousands of years ago in South Africa. And it brings you closer to the late Zachariah Sitchin about mining gold, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's gold all over South Africa, I'm told. And I recently read a paper saying that gold is worth mining if you can get a gram of gold per ton of ore. Think about that for a minute.
Well, you know, there is an archaeological site that is south, I believe it's southwest, I know it's south, I think southwest of Timbuktu in Africa.
Hmm.
That what they are discovering is that it was a city that we would call it a megapolis. It was a gigantic city, twice the size of London.
Wow.
And they're only just beginning to scratch the surface there.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. But imagine that. And this is from, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. And twice the size, a city. This is not a village, twice the size of London.
Well, I've often pushed for the fact that we know so little about the past of our planet, but in our arrogance, if, you know, it was like Heinrich Schliemann finding Troy. The historian said, "What do you mean Troy? That's the Iliad. That's a myth."
Yeah.
You know, Homer wrote a story. Why are you looking? Well, he figured out it wasn't a myth. He was able to pay people to dig down 75 feet, which isn't that far. And they found Troy. This is back about 1875 or so. And that's only from a few thousand years ago. How mm-hmm. much of the planet have we explored down 75 feet, no less 500 feet? We don't know much about the past history of this planet unless you buy into the notion. Bishop Usher, the world was created in 4004 B.C. I think it was a Thursday, October 26th. As I recall. And so there isn't much history beyond what we already know. If you say, oh, you left out a few zeros, there's 4 billion for BC.
Uh-huh.
You know, then it changes the picture entirely. But our learned people are so reluctant to admit ignorance. And yet the essence of science is finding the new, saying, gee, I don't know, let's check it out. Isn't that strange? Isn't that exciting? Isn't that intriguing? Instead, we say it can't possibly be, and I don't see why you're wasting your time on that nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I talk about ancient academics and fossilized physicists.
Yeah, that's the AAFP. Ancient Academics, Fossilized Physicists. That's the association of the AAFP.
I love it. But it's true. You know, I've been out there a lot, and I've seen the attitudes. As a matter of fact, there's a recent survey, the guy's working on a book, of attitudes about Roswell. Was it extraterrestrial or not? And the more education, the less likely to believe it was. The older, the more likely, which has changed from 40 years ago, about the notion of aliens and so forth. But closed minds abound on the academic level. Because, you see, if that were true, that would upset my position here, because I didn't know it was true. So I still got to learn instead of teach, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I get upset at these people because that's what my book Science Was Wrong was about, with Kathleen Martin. We each did 7 chapters. Smart people saying very stupid things which stood in the way of progress about flight, about space travel, about various aspects of medicine, about the paranormal, about UFOs, about abductions, global warming, so-called. It's a scam.
Let me give you an example. Let me give you a great example of the veracity of what you just said. 2 years before the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk, there was a very, very, very well-known man, or he came to be very well-known, who said that it would be 50 years, at least 50 years, before there would be any flying machine that could carry a man, that could carry a human aloft. Do you know who that was?
Simon Newcomb.
Orville Wright.
He's the great astronomer, our greatest astronomer.
No, he said it would never happen.
He wasn't the only one.
Orville Wright is the one who said it.
That doesn't surprise me. They were reluctant.
Yeah.
But they did their homework first, and they realized that the technology as it was incapable of correctly predicting what drag and lift and a whole bunch of other things were. They had to generate their own data. They had a little wind tunnel. Because with the state of the art as it was, ain't gonna happen, no question. We don't know enough. They learned, though. Simon Newcomb made his claim 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight, and we quoted in Science Was Wrong. It's, you know, on the website, www.stantonfriedman.com. But
All right. We
have a whole long history, and that's only one volume. We should probably do another volume because there are plenty of other examples of smart people saying stupid things. And it's unfortunate because there are consequences. You know, there are people who die because they don't get the treatment that has already been demonstrated to work because somebody said, well, that's not the way we do things around here, folks. You know,
yeah.
It gets your dander up, let's put it that way.
Well, you know, heart bypass surgery was invented by a man who was not a doctor.
Was that Bernard?
I can't think of his name. He always wanted to be a doctor, but he was black. And they said, no way are you going to get into medical school. And he was working with a doctor at Johns Hopkins. And he invented the way to do the heart bypass surgery. And they made him...
Impossible.
Everybody said it was impossible. But he invented it. And the doctor he was working with was bold enough to try it. And it worked. And they made this guy, Johns Hopkins, at least was smart enough to make this guy, give him a doctor's degree and allow him to teach surgeons. But he never graduated from medical school and was never a medical doctor.
Well, I'm glad some people recognize talent when they find it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, when I was working on nuclear fusion, the man who was head of our program at Aerojet General Nucleonics had been head of the fusion program at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, John Luce. He had a high school diploma, 40 patents, and an honorary PhD in physics. And he had physicists, guys with PhDs, working for him. Probably the smartest guy I ever worked for. A real motivator of people, too. I really admire John.
All right, we need to get to this flash message, Stanton, that's come in from the United Kingdom. This is from Rose in the United Kingdom, and she says she wants to know from you, how do you see things panning out in the next few years?
Well, I hope I'm still alive to see them pan out, but I'm an old guy, you know. But I still haven't spent overnight in a hospital, so maybe we can keep that up for another 5 years or so. Both my parents lived to be 89, so I'm an optimist, you know. I think that there are going to be some major upheavals. I think some journalist will try to blow the lid off the cosmic Watergate. You know, and I think it would only take 6 months if he could get support from people. I think there will be more people coming forward to Mr. Hastings, for example, and speaking out. And retired General Thomas Jefferson Dubose, who was involved in the Roswell incident, 8th Air Force headquarters, what he said to me in one of our last conversations is, if I remember anything more, Stan, I'll tell you, I like what you're doing. What can they do to me now? He was 86 at the time. So we need more people like that. You know, go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and contact me, and we'll see what we can do. And I've had a couple people suggest that they might have a piece of the wreckage.
Well, that would be cool if you could get your hands on that and get it tested without it getting confiscated.
That's right. That's why I'm not giving any clue as to what part of the country he was from or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But, and I'm not saying that it is definitely a piece. I'm saying I've got a story that says it was, and the way to check is to have it tested, you know, very straightforward. And not that expensive, surprisingly. I've been doing some preliminary checking. So I got my fingers and toes crossed on that one. But no, I think that there's going to be more international recognition. I think things like this Riyadh conference will encourage other people to come forward. And once you get a flood, you know, it's pretty hard to stop it. Mm-hmm. The same thing happened with bringing the wall down. The same thing happened with what's going on, or what has gone on, in Egypt, and will undoubtedly go on in other countries in that part of the world. I'm not going to predict which ones or when, but I'm saying it's happening. And it's pretty hard to stand in the way of that. And so I'm an optimist that we will recognize that we are not the big shots we like to think we are, that the revelation of there being others out there will, you know, it puts an end to the Copernican view of the universe. Remember Copernicus's book, 1543, in which he had the gall, imagine, to suggest that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. The sun was, just one step over. Mm-hmm. The book was banned for 300 years. And Ptolemy's view that the Earth was the center of the universe had gone on for over 1,000. So, with flying saucers, we're taking the next step, that there's a lot of civilizations out there. Look at the Kepler results.
We'll talk about the Kepler results when we come back. We have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Final approach. That means we have just a few minutes left in tonight's show, and the telephone lines are open. If you wish to call, we have time for maybe one call. My guest is Stanton Friedman, and when we went away for break, you were about to mention the discoveries of the Kepler telescope. It has been impressive.
Yes, I did a column about it. I do a monthly column for the MUFON Journal and UFO Magazine, and I did one 2 years ago about Kepler. And the Maclean's Magazine, which is sort of Canada's Time magazine, has a cover story about Kepler and the fact that there's probably, in the first batch of its life, first part of its life, discovered 1,250 more exoplanets. And the two of the guys who were biggest in that business, Marcy and Butler, I guess, They've been following 100 stars for 5 years, stars with exoplanets. And they've cataloged these, and it looks like, contrary to our previous notions about planets, that maybe as many as a quarter of those stars have Earth-sized planets. In other words, we find the big ones first, the Jupiters, because they're easiest to find. But you keep digging and get better equipment and make more observations, because it takes several orbits of the planet around its star to get a good handle on its mass and its orbital time and so forth, period. So I think we're going to find that rather than Frank Drake's 10,000 places in the whole galaxy that might be able to send a radio message, we're going to find 20 million planets on which there might be life. I'm not saying all of them. Maybe only a million. Only a billion, rather.
Yeah, but, you know, of the 12...
The kibosh on Copernicus.
Of the 1,250 or so that new planets that Kepler has found so far, 54 are relatively Earth-like and in what they consider habitable zones. I have a little problem with the habitable zone theory, and the problem I have is what they're saying is we're looking for us. We're looking for life like us. And it's entirely possible for even life like us to be living on the inside in some great cavernous areas inside of planets that on the surface would be inhospitable. But looking for that habitable zone, they're looking for life like us. Look, we have found life on this planet that is allergic to oxygen.
Well,
so
that's right.
You don't have to have oxygen.
Extremophiles are all around us.
Mm-hmm.
Our notions were wrong. You know, absence of evidence is not evidence for absence. The fact that we didn't know that there was life that could handle all these crazy conditions doesn't mean there isn't any, but only that we didn't know it, which is a very different point. So you're right. I have trouble with the Goldilocks zones, is habitable zones, all that sort of stuff. But the point is, there's a zillions of planets out there. Remember, Kepler's only looking at a small hunk of the sky, about one palm's worth if you hold it out in front of you at arm's length and look up at the sky. That's the portion of the sky that it's looking at as it goes around its crazy long elongated orbit.
Yeah, and in that very, very narrow area of the sky that it's looking at, it has found so far 1,250 new planets.
Yeah, and so we were ignorant. That's the simplest way to put it. We were arrogant. Those two go together very often, you understand. And we're ignorant because we're arrogant. We don't want to look because we know what the answer is, you know.
Yeah.
And so what Rose asked about what I imagine things, what's going to happen in the next few years, I think we're going to realize reluctantly that, son of a gun, we're not the big shots in the neighborhood at all. There have been planets suitable for men for a long time, men and women, both, I should say. I don't want to sound sexist here. And I think it may give us, some of us, a little humility that we're not the most advanced creatures God has created, if I can put it that sort of way. And that's part of the picture, though, as we reach out, as we look out, as we recognize our ignorance, we're going to learn a heck of a lot. And a large part of that's going to be, oh, what's the big deal about other life out there? Look at all these places. 60 years ago, you said, there aren't any planets out there. We're it. We're at the top of the heap, guys. And so there's a whole turning over of our viewpoints. And that's important, and in a lot of areas, of course. And we've had a lot of mindsets that turned out to be wrong. And there's nothing wrong with that intrinsically. It delays recognition of what's true. And so you know, there are still wrong notions that we have. But one area where we're going to find out is that there are aliens visiting the planet. That there are people within governments who know that, a few people anyway, that it will affect how we think about ourselves and out there. Now, nobody likes to be told, hey, you're part of a fifth-rate civilization. You guys think you're big shots? Ha! That's nonsense. You're arrogant and ignorant and dangerous and deadly, and we don't want you out here, I think is what's going to happen. And one of the things that I hope will happen, back to Rose's question again, is that when we discover that there are other life out there, somebody's got a library out there in which they can tell us, well, of 1,000 civilizations that started out, you know, 80 went bad in the first 1,000 years, another 200 went bad in the next few 1,000 years. Finally, we got some that have lasted for 1,000,000 years because they changed how they did things. Progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. So whether it's you control reproduction, whether you control growing food, whether you say, hey, eating meat takes up an awful lot of the ground on this planet, and I like a good steak as much as the other guy and anybody else, but grains are a much more efficient way of using the limited space on the planet and the resources of the planet. We're in for some changes, some big ones. But I think it's exciting to be alive when we make such discoveries. You know.
Well, I would agree with you. I can't think of a more exciting time in Earth's history. Of course, I wasn't alive during other great epoch-changing times, but I've read about the changes and so forth. But, you know, this is really, really exciting because we're seeing a lot of Earth changes. We're seeing a lot of social changes. We're seeing a lot of economic changes. And we're seeing a great many changes in the body of knowledge that's available to know. And I say all the time, when you compare what we actually know with what there is to know, what we actually know is microscopic. Stanton, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. It's been a joy, a pleasure, and a delight, as always, to have you with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure to be on, and I'll remind people of www.stantonfriedman.com. Read what I've written. My strong comments and my not-so-strong ones, and look at the books, and if you buy them from me, you get an autograph. You don't get that from Amazon.
Okay. And, folks, if you click on Stanton's picture on my site, it's linked. It'll take you to his site. Well, this week has already been exciting, hasn't it? And we're not finished yet. We have another blazing show to bring you tomorrow night. So you want to be sure and be here. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.